Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590 The Fan. I'm Blake Murphy. She's Ailish Forfar. He's JD Bunkus. Vic back there, playing a little dirt off your shoulders. Something else we can brush off, maybe the Freddie Freeman to Toronto Blue Jays rumors, thanks to Carlos Baerga's Instagram. To help us break that down and talk about all things Blue Jays right now, Shai Davidi, Sportsnet MLB insider and columnist. Shai, good morning.
Good morning, guys. How's it going?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm all right. Quite the little bit of speculation Carlos Baerga threw into the world yesterday, huh?
Yeah, I'm mostly impressed with the Photoshop skills and the adding the sound effects to something like that. Normally it's just some guy tweeting or posting on a forum or something, and you just kind of throw it away. But to invest all that time into the Photoshops
it's
and
funny
to the sound
way.
Effects.
It's funny either way, because either he has a guy that he asks to do that.
Like, can you make these things happen?
He's like, you know, I like it when there's fire on them. He's like, yeah, do it. Do it with the fire. Like, that's the world I actually prefer, rather than he does it himself.
In seriousness, Freddie Freeman is obviously an excellent, excellent baseball player, a great left-handed hitter. At the price tag being kicked around out there for Freddie Freeman, that doesn't make a lot of sense to the Blue Jays for you at first blush, right?
I mean, it's not only that. I think the bigger piece that is problematic here is, you know, are you seriously going to disrupt Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Mm-hmm. just when, you know, he finally started to lock in and become what you expect him to be, right? He's developed a comfort at first base. He's dedicated to it. And, you know, like, to suddenly think you're going to throw him back to third base or split him at DH for space, you know, that's not really logical. And, you know, the other thing is, like, if the Blue Jays were really intent on doing this, you'd have to really start kind of putting some of these pieces together and doing some of the legwork and preparing people like Vladimir Guerrero Jr. for a switch, and none of that has taken place. So, you know, this really just strikes me as due diligence and, you know, really nothing more than that.
Makes sense to me. So we're looking at this Kevin Gausman, Robbie Ray decision, and Kevin Gausman gets 5 years, $110 million with the Blue Jays. Robbie Ray gets 5 years, $115 million, with an opt-out with the Seattle Mariners. You had a column up at sportsnet.ca, Gausman's arrival, Ray's departure, instructive on how Blue Jays are operating. Before we get into the operational aspect and what this tells us about their direction, those contracts are different, and the compensation pick's a real thing, but they're close enough that, do you think the Blue Jays just straight up like Kevin Gausman better than Robbie Ray over this five-year window, and maybe more importantly, over the shorter end of this contract as well?
Well, I think there are a couple ways to look at it, right? You know, one, was this a Blue Jays decision, or was this also, you know, a circumstantial or player decision too, right? You know, as recently as Sunday, there was some stuff floating around that Robbie Ray might wait it out until after the lockout to sign, and, you know, maybe wasn't ready to make a commitment yet. And it seemed like Kevin Gausman clearly was. And so if you're the Blue Jays and you're looking for some certainty, maybe that's what tipped the scales for you. You know, on the flip side, maybe, you know, the impression that the Blue Jays had was that, you know, Robbie Ray was leaning towards going to somewhere else. You know, in the press release from the Seattle Mariners last night, he noted about how much, you know, he enjoyed being in the Pacific Northwest and that he really wanted to go there. And so maybe the sense that the Blue Jays had was that, you know, he would not have been able to come back, or wasn't willing to come back because of either personal preferences or circumstances. And so, you know, the Blue Jays opted for or pushed on the bird in hand, which was Kevin Gausman. So, you know, I think that the exact details, you know, hopefully we'll get a little bit more information on that today and shed a little bit of light on it. But I think either way, you're talking about two guys, even though they do it a little bit differently, you know, have similar profiles with, you know, a very well-spotted fastball and a truly elite secondary pitch that they're able to use to great effect.
So yesterday on the Blair and Barker show, Jeff Blair reported that Robbie Ray's vaccination status, he's unvaccinated. So do you think that that might have played a role in his departure from, you know, the Canadian rules and the legislations that we have up here?
Well, I don't know specifics on that, whether or not he is. But without a doubt, the Blue Jays have noticed that change and have to take it into account. And I think they've been trying to work to get a little bit more clarity from the federal government as to what that's going to mean, because that is an implication not only for who they can play, which would obviously be their prime concern, but also who can come in from other teams. And, you know, we do know that there are, you know, some teams, you know, the Mariners being one of them, with a sizable number of unvaccinated players on the roster. And, you know, that's going to create potentially some significant issues for clubs who are arriving here next year. So, you know, I definitely think that that's something that had to play into the Blue Jays, roles, whether it's specific to that situation, you know, I can't say.
Yeah, I'm starting to wonder if it is going to be more of a competitive advantage, like, because we've already seen that this, like, or whether if it's an advantage or if it's a disadvantage, right? Like, one where you go, hey, this legislation has always changed. This is kind of an always moving target. Now we got Omicron, right? And okay, so what's the next thing that ends up happening here? Are they going to end up being lockdowns? Is there going to be more restrictions? What's going to happen? Who knows? Like, trying to predict these things is really tough. But yeah. Could I see a scenario where public says, you know what, we don't want people who aren't vaccinated here, even if they are playing sports? Okay, maybe, who knows? Maybe this exemption doesn't end up sticking. Maybe Toronto ends up in a place where some guys can't come up here and end up playing games. But do you feel as though this, like that uncertainty, and I know it's weird because Gossman just signed, but again, these stories change so rapidly that it's been an actual real barrier for the Blue Jays in free agency so far, that this has been something that has been coming up with a lot of free agents, or that this has been something that, you know, extends beyond their negotiations with Ray?
Well, I mean, we know that the Major League Baseball populace in totality was in the last time Major League Baseball released some numbers in excess of 85% vaccinated, right?
Good.
So it would depend on which players happen to be in free agency. You know, if you're dealing with vaccinated players whose families are also vaccinated, we don't have an issue. But if there is a player who is unvaccinated and who's intent on staying that way, then you do have a problem. So, you know, I do think that it's a factor, but it's only as debilitating, or it's only debilitating for them if you're targeting players who are unvaccinated and intent on not getting the shot. So, you know, I do think that that's wholly circumstantial. And, you know, there's a segment of of the vast majority of players it's not going to be an issue for. But there are some, and some that you may potentially target, who you have to go into it with your eyes open and understanding that there may be consequences of that down the road.
So the piece of the, I'm going to go back to Freddie Freeman for a second, because yeah, I looked at it and thought the same thing you did, which is, hey, this doesn't make sense from a team structure standpoint. This doesn't seem to make sense from a budget standpoint. But originally when I saw it, because I didn't know what Freddie Freeman was going to be asking for, and you know, he's, I think 32, 33. So I wondered, hey, is this someone who actually is comfortable slotting into a DH role? Turns out not, right? You know, you do some digging and the things you raised are the major concerns. But the reason I even thought it could be possible in the first place was that we're a year removed from them trying to acquire Michael Brantley, right? That they went out and they thought, hey, maybe we're going to try to get essentially a DH, this lefty bat who can hit for average, hit for power, veteran leadership, all those different things. So I thought, oh, okay, you know, maybe there is some legitimacy to this. I guess where I'm going with it, though, is I was shocked by the number, and I went, okay, they got to be out on that. But do you think that the budget is a little bit more flexible than what we had originally thought entering this offseason? Because even if they're talking to some of the guys and they're doing their due diligence, I guess I can't really differentiate as an outsider as compared to someone like you, how much of it is due diligence versus how much of it is, hey, we actually might have legitimate interest here, and if the right player comes along, we're gonna spend that money.
Well, I mean, let's take a step back, and then, you know, the general principle, and the Blue Jays aren't the only team, I would think that the vast majority, if not all the teams, do this, is that they try to talk to everybody and they try to get a sense of what the market is. And I would say that if you're talking to first baseman, the Blue Jays might potentially have a bit more interest in getting a sense of where the market for first baseman are going, knowing that at some point in time they're going to want to try and extend Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And maybe they're trying to build a scenario or some comps for how you might compensate, you know, someone for someone like Guerrero for an extension over that period of time in his career. So, you know, I think there are lots of different reasons why teams reach out to players. Now, is the budget piece, is it flexible? I mean, what we've consistently heard from, you know, Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro is that, you know, there are scenarios that they can present to ownership if there are opportunities where they may potentially be able to go past the budgetary plan that's been approved to, that's been approved. Just because, you know, sometimes business presents you with opportunities that are too good to pass up and that may cause you to veer course. So I would say that that is true to a degree, but, you know, it's not just, I don't think they're going to go to ownership and say, hey, you know, we really like this, this sort of middling reliever and we need a little bit of extra money. But if they could make a business case for a specific player and say, hey, this is an opportunity we didn't anticipate. This is something that could change the franchise and would have this level of impact on our, on the revenues we generate, then, you know, they can certainly do that and perhaps get approval.
So no real surprises yesterday at the non-tender deadline, maybe a little bit of one with Breivik Valera being released, but our budget hasn't, or not the budget, but the payroll estimate hasn't really changed. All the ARB eligible guys are headed to ARB. And that looks like about 150, 151 million committed. Does that keep the Jays in? And I know you just said they could go to the to ownership and ask for more in the right situation. We had John Morosi on yesterday, and he said that Chris Taylor is one of the priorities for the Blue Jays right now. He also mentioned a Chris Bryant. We've obviously heard the Jose Ramirez stuff a lot in the past. What is the Jays' likeliest path to addressing the infield loss of Marcus Semien? Because right now it looks like there's, depending on how you shape it up, there's a hole at either second or third.
Yeah, I still think they're going to find a way to add an infielder. And, I really wonder about trade at some point because, you know, I've made this point a few times and, you know, I think some people may be sick of hearing it, but it's a significant one because, you know, the biggest loss from Semien, Mats, and Rays, not only the production, but it's their financial efficiency, right? You know, mm-hmm. The Jays paid those three guys $31.2 million last year, you know, and they parlayed that one-year commitment from the team into $334 million in contracts. So, you know, the Blue Jays need to find a way to get some elite-level production from somebody at a controllable contract or a manageable salary, and that's something that you can typically do through trade. And so, you know, the Blue Jays have preferred to do their work via free agency, or at least tried initially to go as far as their money can take them. But, you know, they still need a fifth starter. They still want an infielder. They still probably want, you know, another reliever or two. You know, if you're going to do all that, it's going to be tough to do that in free agency alone. So, you know, I certainly see a trade being a real possibility for the Jays. And there's some really dynamic players out there. So, you know, I also do think that it's interesting that Ross Atkins has, at a couple different junctures, really talked up Kevin Biggio and his belief that Kevin Biggio is going to bounce back. You know, I think that he's definitely going to be a part of the plan one way or the other. And so, you know, that may cover one of the infield spots and then leave the Blue Jays to, you know, plug one more hole there.
So you just mentioned that they're still looking for a fifth starter, and that's been sort of bandied around for a while now. Does that have any say as to how the organization feels about Nate Pearson? Because when we talked to Pete Walker about a week ago, he had mentioned that he still believes that the guy is a starting pitcher. And if he is a starting pitcher, then you would assume that he's going to be coming into camp healthy and that he's going to be coming into camp with an opportunity to compete for one of those jobs. It's hard not to read into them giving some, like, actual, even, you know, a halfway decent fifth-end starter ends up looking like they're going to get money in this market. Like, what does that say about Nate Pearson's future?
Well, I do think the Blue Jays still see him as a starter, and they don't want to, and they're going to exhaust that possibility, I believe, before they commit to him as a reliever on a full-time basis. But one thing you have to take into account with him is that, you know, unlike Alek Manoah, who had had some more innings under his belt on a consistent basis before the pandemic interruption, you know, Nate Pearson had his 2020 season marred by injury, his 21 season marred by injury. You know, the career high is still 100 and something innings, and it's been a lot. He's two plus years removed from that at this point. You know, how much can you realistically put on him next year without risking his injury? And so I think that the Blue Jays are at least kicked around the idea about, you know, maybe using him in some sort of, you know, Luis Patino type of role, the way the Rays did last year with their right-hander, you know, having him make some shorter starts, you know, extending him on occasions, really carefully managing his innings. And, you know, if you're doing that, you know, and he's in this, you know, quasi-hybrid kind of role, just as a way to manage his workload, then you probably still need somebody else in the rotation. And, you know, maybe you want to parachute a sixth starter in every once in a while as a way to manage workload for, you know, guys like Manoah still and Ryu and ensuring everybody stays healthy. So, you know, I think there are definitely some ways for the Blue Jays to be creative with someone like a Pearson while continuing him on a starter trajectory and also keeping in mind how you have to manage his workload so that he can get through a season wire to wire healthy.
So Blake mentioned a little bit ago that Breivik was released. And so that's a reminder that they need to add a little bit of depth to the Jays roster. So when and how do you think that they could be addressing something of that sort?
Well, I you know, part I think of the Valera thing is that, you know, the Blue Jays feel pretty good about the progress that Otto Lopez has made. And him becoming an option, you know, feeling good about having Kevin Biggio, who, you know, they missed for long stretches of time last year, having Santiago Espinal there as well. And, you know, if, you know, a bunch of things had to kind of break his way to open up that playing time for Valera last year. But, you know, if Biggio's back on track and, you know, Santiago Espinal is also healthy, you know, Valera sort of becomes a bit of a redundancy. And, you know, he's someone that the Blue Jays, you know, have, there have been some people in that front office who believe that, you know, there's more there, and they've kind of liked him for a long time. They found ways to carry him through the pandemic season when he was among the players who couldn't get out of Venezuela because of travel restrictions. And then, you know, eventually found a spot for him. But, you know, I think that for him too, personally, that he wants to pursue some opportunities overseas. And, you know, the Blue Jays wanted to grant him that, knowing that he wasn't a lock to be on their roster.
Well, that's nice of them. Also nice of you to come on and talk with us this morning. Shai Davidi, Sportsnet MLB insider and columnist. You can check out his latest, Gossman's Arrival, Ray's Departure, instructive on how Blue Jays are operating at sportsnet.ca. Shai, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Yeah, pleasure as always, guys. Have a great day.
Shai Davidi.
You have a great day.
Leaves us with a little something to chew on, which it's time for. Brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. Mm-hmm. Within that piece, in talking about fifth starter candidates, Shai mentions Yusei Kikuchi, who, I don't know, I would have thought was above the budget tier of what the Jays are shopping for there.
Can I tell you that as a Mariners person that I've watched Kikuchi pitch for a couple of years and I've never even, like, actually said his first name? It's the first time.
Yusei?
Yeah.
Just, I was waiting for Blake to say
it. Everyone,
you know,
just calls him Kikuchi.
Kikuchi.
And that's it? And that was the first, it was like jarring to hear you say it that way. So I was like, wow.
You
all
say
right.
Kikuchi.
He's got, I forgot. It doesn't have one name.
So
it's like Ichiro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something Shai mentioned in that piece is that the Jays have tended to be attracted to guys who throw split fingers. Mm-hmm. And Gossman obviously qualifies. Kikuchi sometimes gets logged as a changeup, not a split finger. Apparently it's a changeup that has a split finger grip. So actually, both can be true. It's a split finger changeup, not a split finger fastball. But that pitch was used sparingly by him last year, and it was really, really effective. Opponents hit just 176 against it, and he had almost a 40% whiff rate on that split change. He also has really strong whiff rates on his fastball and his slider. Seems like a potential, hey, let's change your approach, let's change your pitch mix a bit, guy. Something to chew on when you're looking at potential other names to throw into the fifth starter mix for the Blue Jays. That's brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
They sign Kikuchi, then I don't see there being a path for Nate Pearson to start on this team next year. Out of the gate.
No.
Like, the sixth swingman is supposed to be Ross, is supposed to be your old chicken strip.
Yeah.
Stripling. So
chicken strip.
Well, I just don't really see, again, like, I could see taking like a million plus like flyer, right? Somebody who was like Matt's last year. I know he wasn't $1 million. What did Matt's cost last year? Five?
Something like that.
Yeah. So
a Dylan Bundy type.
Right. Someone who is guaranteed nothing. You sign Kikuchi, he's guaranteed a starting spot. He's getting a starting spot. And you could say, well, there in injury insulation, he needs some time to build it up. And that, like, that's cool. But also, Nate Pearson was basically expected to be a starting pitcher on the Blue Jays last year. So the idea of him being like a couple of starters insulated from the rotation in a year where you're all in and trying to win, I don't know. To me, that feels very much like either he's a trade piece or he's a bullpen piece for next year. Like, not that you're keeping him stretched out in Buffalo and you're giving him a half season down there and he's trying to get the Manoah path up from a year. I just don't see that.
I don't think it's, at this point in his development, I don't know what that's pushing forward for him.
That's what I mean.
So, yeah, I'm with you. I do think, but this has been the case, and I don't mean just with Kikuchi. I mean, in general, like every one of our Jays people we've had on has said the Jays are still looking to add there. Ben Nicholson-Smith said it. Yeah. Shai said it. Morosi said it. Mm-hmm. That is an area that the Jays are apparently still looking to address. So, yeah, you could take that as, hey, the Pete Walker conversation we had about Nate Pearson is legitimate, but also maybe a little bit of, hey, let's keep the faith up on this guy. Let's keep chatter up around him. But also, like, maybe he ends up a bullpen guy.
Yeah. And it's also harder to do right now because it's all about free agency. Mm-hmm. And so you could go, oh, there's no buzz about trades, which I have done. And then you go, yeah, it's because nobody's talking about them right now. They're just trying
it's
to get deals
the
done.
Priority.
Yeah. There's
and,
no trade.
And like I said earlier, if I'm a team that's trading from a position of strength in terms of controllable win now pieces, I'm asking for a lot with the way this free agent market is going.
Right.
So I could see that being a little slower to develop.
Oof, we have Ennis later, and he has his belief when it comes to getting Ramirez is, yeah, he thinks it's steeper than what we tried to do. Let's just put it that way.
Like, he's in, I know baseball doesn't have a trade machine, but they've got that weird, like, prospect valuation machine.
No, I don't think he's ever used that. Ennis is old, man. He doesn't know how to use the internet, really.
Also, I don't like
that. Have you seen his tweets?
No.
Like, yeah.
That's probably why. Have you seen them?
He's really old. He's shockingly old. He's in his 40s. You know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's 44.
He's good for 44.
No, he's 44 years old. Yeah. Ennis, 44.
No wonder you like
him
so much.
It'll be you guys soon, eh?
He's 40.
I feel like I look more 44 than he does.
No, I'm it's wild, man. He's 44.
Damn.
Yeah.
It's a whole
good
adult.
Good job,
Ennis. It'd be nice to have.
Good job, yeah.
It'd be nice to have one adult on the show a little 44. Later.
Yeah, so let's we'll talk to the 44-year-old later. But yeah, that's a
9 o'clock.
Something to chew on.
Brought to you
tweet
by Greg
at Ben
Canadian
that he's 44. Yeah. You know, say happy 45th
birthday. How did this happen?
Happy upcoming 45th birthday, Ben Ennis. Later today. Later today, the old man himself, he'll drop by to do some takes.
Also later today, we have Steve Dangle at the 8 o'clock hour.
Hey.
We've got the WWE champ, Big E, coming on at 9:30.
Wow.
Big meaty men slapping meat. As
what
Big E would say.
That's inappropriate.
That was in the doc, and I was I'm not even going to comment.
That's his thing.
He tweeted it.
It's I did tweet it. Yeah,
no.
I'm
your
trying
account's
to,
suspended
I'm
now.
Trying to ingratiate myself to our guest, Big E, the WWE champ. That's at 9:30 as well. And after the break, we'll talk a little Raptors. It's a Fan Morning Show. Sports at 590 The Fan.
Hey, Leafs fans. We're giving you a chance to win tickets to the Maple Leafs Lightning game on December 9th. Today's code word is Stamkos. Text Stamkos to 590-590 for your shot to win.
Good morning. It's Fan Morning Show. Sports at 590 The Fan. Blake Murphy. She's hey. Ailish Forfar in a terrific sweater today.
Once dangled Connor McDavid, if you had never heard.
Yeah, once Connor McDavid did Steve Dangle, but that's the 8 o'clock hour.
You got, have Bunkus. You told that to Dangle?
No, I haven't.
You got to bring him.
Actually, I might have told the story on NHL chat room when we worked together, but I don't really remember.
That show doesn't exist.
Yeah, it could again though.
No, that was a sports. Sorry, I thought it was at the other place, and you've drilled into my head that nothing I've done elsewhere exists.
Neither of you have done anything other than this.
You probably go back and watch the YouTube versions of it, NHL chat room.
For sure. I will say, as a quick side note, I would really like to see you doing more digital hosting. It's just tough with these hours, right? Anything anybody asks you to do, I know. Anybody,
more energy.
And he's like, hey, JD, can you just do this quick thing? And I go, no. Leave me alone. I'm in the cave with all the lights off. That's why I can't believe Blake every Tuesday does Will Lose Show.
Yeah.
Every Tuesday. I
you better be getting good extra cash for that.
Nothing.
I'm a regular on Real Kipper and Born, but I do it from home and they get
and
me to do
you
a block.
Forget to do
and
it.
That was rude and I didn't need that. Yeah, I didn't need that reminder. And I haven't been asked to be on since.
Oh, there's drama.
Yeah, Kipper saw us at the photo shoot and he was all like, oh, what's up, bud? What's up, bud? How you doing, bud? And made some jokes and, you know, gassed up Ailish and then crapped on us.
Oh, he did gas me up.
Called me the wrong
time.
Name for like the ninth straight week.
I love that. I hope that he does that.
I can't tell.
What does he call you?
He calls me different things.
He's called you Jake. He's called you Jay.
Yeah, it was Jay last week. And I don't know if it's a bit or.
I honestly just don't think if he's getting Ailish, but he's not getting your name. It's got to be a bit.
I just figured. Thanks, Jake. Yeah, see you later, Jake. And he gave you a shoulder tap, too. So did he call you Jake when he shoulder tapped?
Yeah, no, he called me Jay.
Oh, love it.
Yeah.
So good.
And, like, I see him every week when I do the Will Lou thing because him and Bourne come in right after.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I need to do a quick thing now before we jump into the Raptors and our Siakam stuff, which is quickly, I have this strong belief that if someone doesn't, like, I think you're the bad guy here.
And I'm not correcting him?
You have to tell him.
But what am I going to do, correct him on air?
I think that you have had your chances. You've had your chances to have him on the air, have you reset going and Blake Murphy, like, do something, and then privately reach out. He follows you on Twitter, right?
I don't know.
Probably. Well, you could get it. Here's what I'll tell you. I have Kipper's number. I'll give it to you. You know,
oh my
you can say,
goodness.
Hey, it's Blake from the morning show.
Hey, man, it's Jake. Just letting you know my name's Blake.
But here's the thing. Now it's too late. Now you're just Jake. You should say when he comes on, I'm going to introduce you as Jake Murphy. He's on tomorrow. So this is great. We get to actually hash this up. But either way, I think.
You should say to Kipper when he gets on, name everybody's name on the show.
No, but see that's what I'm saying is you're the bad guy. We haven't done a who's the bad guy in a while. But you're the bad guy because there's nothing worse than when you call someone the wrong name for a significant period of time. And then that person goes, actually, my name is blank. You're like, huh? This was so much less awkward after I said it the first or the second time. You can't let me just go on. And then at some arbitrary time, you decide like, now I'm dropping this bomb on you because it makes you seem like you're just like the most inconsiderate, rude person in the world when you get somebody's name wrong. And usually it has nothing to do with that.
You know what I'm thinking of now is the Succession episode where Cousin Greg is first introduced and he keeps getting referred to as Craig.
Yeah.
And then Shiv has to be like, wait a second. Isn't your name Greg? And he's like, yeah, but enough people say Craig that I'll just answer to it.
Right. So I just think if you're going to do that move where you're the person that doesn't say what your actual name is, then you can never bring up, hey, you've been getting my name wrong. So who's the bad guy? Person who gets the name wrong or person who doesn't say the proper pronunciation of their name after someone gets it wrong?
Normally, I would agree with you, but I think in this case, because it's happened on air and I'm new to a job and Kipper's far more established than me, there's a power imbalance there where would feel very awkward.
Invoking power dynamics. Ailish, where are you at?
As somebody that constantly has her name mispronounced.
Ailish.
I'll say, don't worry, like, everybody gets it wrong. It's not a problem. Like, and then I'll say, I've got an eyelash, English, Alicia, eyelash. Ashley, Ainsley, and then I'll make them feel better about getting it wrong.
I love ones like English where, yeah. like, first of all, not only are they adding letters in there, but that's not a name.
Mm-hmm. So basically, most of the time they'll either be like, is it Eilish? And they'll know that they're hesitant about it. So it makes it easier. It's not like my name is Blake and they're getting it mm-hmm. blatantly wrong. Like I usually have better.
You're the bad guy now. Blatantly wrong.
Paul from Peterborough just texted in. My neighbor's name is Kurt and I called him Kirk for 3 years. That's on him.
Yeah, that is on him. Mm-hmm. I say screw Kirk. Yeah. You know, like.
Are you saying panned?
Yeah.
Pan? Is it Pam? Panned.
You gotta step up. You gotta not be a coward. You gotta tell people what your actual name is. Again,
guy who goes by initials instead of his real name.
But that's the thing.
Although I don't go by my real name either. So.
But that's also it though. Is like you say your name to people and they get it wrong, and I'm like, okay, I correct you so many times. I can only do that so many times, right? And so I think that everybody has to basically be that way where you step up and you say, or you just accept that you're some doormat who doesn't like your eyelasher over here.
Sorry. I just clued into something that you said earlier that I need. Uh-huh. You said, doesn't he follow you?
Uh-huh.
And I just checked and he does.
Yeah, he does.
So
you.
He would obviously know that my name is Blake.
No, he wouldn't. How many people does Kipper follow? Probably like 2,000.
2,000 or something.
Yeah, but I'm saying you could have DM'd him and been like, hey, this is me from the morning show. That's what it was. Anyway, not that
it's really not a big deal. Yeah. It didn't mean it to be a 10-minute segment.
But it was fun. I liked it. I
thought
liked
it was
like
just
this.
A funny thing.
So back to the Raptors.
Yes.
I'll get us back on track here. But yes, who's the bad guy? People who get the name wrong or people who don't say? Tweet us, text us, do all those things. I love those stories. I love the Kurt story. So last night, the Raptors lose to the Grizzlies, and it's just a crappy game. We went over it to a degree where you go, man, how are you supposed to be mad when they're missing these players? But then also, should those players matter this much? And should you still lose to a Grizzlies team that doesn't have Ja Morant when you're at home? And there's a whole bunch of crap. But I thought, man, I tweeted this. There's a line in The Wire about 40-degree days. And if you're a fan of The Wire, you know it. And Ailish, The Wire is a show that came on before you were born, so you don't. But essentially, I'm not going to quote everything from it, but that this the one of the bosses, essentially, Stringer Bell. I don't know how to do this analogy. Maybe the show is too old. Maybe I'm too old to do my analogies. But he tells his group that they're giving him too many 40-degree days. And essentially, that a 40-degree day is fine. That no one remembers a 40-degree day. That 60, people might go have a barbecue. 20, people are going to be bitching. But 40, it passes you by without thought. And that's sort of how I've been feeling about Siakam lately. If you look at his numbers and you've just watched him play, it's like sub 50%, you know, 18-ish, 19-ish points a game. Maybe he cracks 20 every once in a while. He was cracking 20 on a regular basis when he first came back. Now that's dipped off a little bit. And a couple rebounds, not enough rebounds, a couple of assists, a couple of turnovers, a couple of threes, but nothing that just like really sticking out right now. And last night was the first time where I didn't really feel like it was all his fault, because I'm looking at it and I'm saying, you're supposed to be the man, you're supposed to be the man, blah, 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 blah. But the team isn't really treating him like the man. Like, they're down on these players, and you would think this is going to be a high-usage game for Siakam where they just feed him. Mm. And, Blake, I want to ask you this. Is this a little bit more... We are always very reluctant to criticize Fred VanVleet because we are both big Fred VanVleet guys, and I've always said Fred gives you what your team needs. And I kind of feel like last night was one of the first games I watched where I went, hey, Fred, the team actually needs less of you and more of Siakam. Hey, Nick Nurse, where are you two guys in this equation? Where is your part of this?
Yeah, and I mean, Fred VanVleet only took 13 shots last night.
He had 3 assists.
It's tough when no one's making shots.
Sure, but
like 10 of 39 on threes.
It was not a scenario where it felt like he gets compared to Kyle Lowry a lot in a positive way, so I'm going to do it in a negative way. Mm. I don't remember a lot of Kyle Lowry games where he's running point. Like, this is where when people call Fred VanVleet a shooting guard, not a point guard, that I felt it last night, where I'm going, hey, You're supposed to, when people are out of the lineup, be the setup man for Siakam. Why do you have better pick and roll chemistry with Chris Boucher than you do with Siakam?
Like, oh, that was a nice lob.
It was, but you know what I'm getting at here, right? Like, those two should have better chemistry, and I can't really figure out why they don't.
I mean, I think they do. I think we've seen that Siakam.
You said better, not none.
Okay.
Yeah.
But like, that's been the story with those two for years, is that they have a good chemistry together. And I think, yeah, there are, Siakam is not a natural center, so he's not a natural pick and roll man. And they still have to figure some of that stuff out. But I think my gripe was not as much with VanVleet as it was the overall offensive process in this game. And by that, I mean, first of all, they had 14 assists as a team, which is just, no matter who you're going to stick that on, that is criminally low, even on a poor shooting night as a team. So that's one. I thought from a process standpoint, yeah, your point of like, why aren't you relying on Siakam more in a game like this? He did have 19 field goal attempts in 30 minutes, and he used 21 possessions. That's not a ton. It's not a crazy
number.
He was
in foul trouble, so he had to sit for a bunch of the game. But he was also lobbing threes at the end of the game where they were out of it, and like, those were a few of them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But my issue is more that, first of all, you've got some stretches where you're using Fred and Pascal to prop up those bench units that just like really don't have any business having three or four of those guys on the court at a time right now. And the ball isn't in their hands. So there's one possession that stood out where Fred and Pascal were both standing on the perimeter as Malachi Flynn and Precious Achiuwa ran an action together. And I know that you need Malachi Flynn reps and you need Precious Achiuwa reps over the course of the season, but this was a close game in a lineup that really needed one of those guys to be the leader. And that was, and I'm fairly sure it was the script, because it was a half court possession. And I don't think Malachi Flynn has the freedom in the offense to take the ball from Fred and Pascal and call something like that. So there was some process side stuff like that. I also thought that, and this is something that I've thought a little bit for the last couple games, and it's something that is a bigger conversation. It's about how Pascal Siakam fits with this group coming back. And obviously the team's record is really bad since Siakam came back. And that's not, you know, correlation is not causation, but it obviously looks a certain way. And the offense over the last couple games, you know, when Siakam came back, we kept being like, oh, well, at least the offense is good. At least the offense is good. Mm-hmm. The offensive rating over this 3-game losing streak is under 100. That's under a point per possession. That's not going to fly in the modern NBA. You're not going to win games that way. So Siakam's been fine individually. He's averaged 18.6 over the last five. Every game it's been between 17 and 21 points, to your point, JD, about 40 degree days. The larger question to address here, I think, is has Siakam, at least when they're thinned out, and this is maybe not fair to him because he came back and we were like, hey, you got to fit in, you got to find your spots in the offense. You got to seed some of your usage because Scottie Barnes has taken reps now and Fred's become a bit more of the guy. And now they're a little shorthanded and he's still in that mode. And I think the team needs him to be a little bit more of, at least for right now, of like, hey, no, give me the ball. I'm the man. And this is where it gets really tough because there was a long stretch there when he first came back where we didn't want him to do that. You wanted him to fit in. You wanted the assist rate to be higher. You wanted him to be like, okay, I know I'm Siakam and I can get my 20, but how do I get that within what's working here? And now it's like, okay, you're so thinned out and your team can't score. You got to assert yourself on the game a little bit more. And I don't know, you know, I think the attempt to fit in and find your way in a kind of collaborative setting is admirable. Mm-hmm. But I do wonder if on nights like that, and especially when they're thinned out, if it's coming at the expense of, you know, hey, this team really needs to rely on Siakam to score right now. And I know that's a long-winded way of teeing up that, hey, we're asking Siakam to change his role on the fly a couple times here because he's your highest paid player and supposed to be your best player. But that's what gets asked of you sometimes.
So why I'm bringing this up, though, is because you and I, well, we've all three of us have had conversations about how it's hard to talk about Siakam. Because when you criticize him, he's such a whipping boy right now that it feels like, again, identity politics. It felt like, you know, during the offseason when you talk about Kyle Dubas, where you're either in a camp or you're not, or Marner, where it's just either you sound like you're trying way too hard to defend the guy or you're killing the guy. And I actually don't think it is that way. I think it's pretty reasonable to say, hey, You got to be more than this in a game with no jaw against the Grizzlies when you're at home. And you got to have some, you got to impose yourself on this basketball game. So the foul trouble, like, that's part of it though, right? Like, you're not excused from getting into foul trouble. That's on you. You're the player who gets into foul trouble in a big, meaningful game like that. So,
and I do think there's an element of pressing on the defensive end where, yeah, like, we've been pretty fairly critical of his defense as he came back, and he's had some really great stretches. Like the second half of that Memphis game stands, yeah, out, but you know, last night the fouls were, and one of those fouls I'm almost certain should have been on Precious Achiuwa, not Siakam. Mm-hmm. But you can, either way, you could probably do that in a lot of games. But yeah, they were kind of crimes of like maybe trying to do a little too much.
Mm. So this is where I was at with it last night. It felt like to me he was checking out too much. That part of it has to just be him going into manning the ball, and it has to be able to be him sealing and asking for entry passes inside. Because the one thing I've really liked about Siakam's game this offseason is when he gets into the paint, he looks better. He looks like he's got a more refined post game than he's had in years past, where he can catch it with his back to the basket, sort of walk down a defender or identify that he's quicker with somebody and get to his spots with a better ease.
Look at the fourth quarter. So there was a stretch in the fourth quarter where Jaren Jackson Jr. checks out for a little bit. And Jaren Jackson Jr. was a defensive monster in this game. Like single game plus minus for an individual often does not tell you a lot of stuff. Go and look at Jaren's for these two games between these teams, and it's striking. He was plus 21 in 34 minutes last night. And the second he checked out of this game was what I think is what they need more of from Siakam right now.
Yes.
And it was like it wasn't four possessions in a row, but it was four possessions in a row the Raptors scored on. So there was a stretch where he went on, basically he had 9 straight points for the Raptors, and they were all just him eating Kyle Anderson. And so, it was get to the rim for an and-one, and then it was use that space to pull up in mid-range, mm-hmm, and it was use that kind of high post game that you have where, hey, you have the post experience now and you have the jumper experience now, so that lets you kind of combine those two skill sets. And like, obviously you can't just be like, hey, what you did to Kyle Anderson, go do it against Jaren Jackson Jr. But I think that's a snapshot of what you're looking for from Siakam.
I just want to see him be a little bit more aggressive, and I don't want to watch a game where Jaren Jackson Jr. is the player of the game and Pascal Siakam is in it. Because Jaren Jackson is a fine player, but Pascal Siakam is at a point in his career where he should be the clear and obvious best player in that game last night. And it felt like that for moments, but it didn't feel like that for the entire game. Foul trouble, again, affects it. Who he's surrounded with, I don't really want to hear it as an excuse, because what I'm asking is that you figure it out. You're the best player on this team. You figure it out. The reason why I brought up Fred VanVleet is, you guys remember when we were doing the practice shows and we got the Fred VanVleet clip of, hey, Siakam's got to be able to get 40 shots and nobody blinks, is because I actually don't think Fred has done the best job of setting up Siakam this year so far. Like, I don't. Mm. In a game like last night, I do want to see Fred take on a bit more of a role of, hey, it's the two of us. Hey, it's the two of us. It's the two of us getting involved. It's the two of us making that happen. And the reason that felt even bigger to me was because when Boucher came in, it kind of felt like Fred was like, hey, Chris, don't worry. Like, I'm going to make sure that you get yours. I'm going to make sure that we are highlighting the things that you do well. And I just didn't see enough of that from Siakam. And I know that part of it's on him. Part of it's on his surroundings. Part of it's on the coaching staff. Part of it's the evolution of the role. Part of it's
chemistry together.
Totally. It's a lot of different factors. I'm just saying that they got to figure it out, because to me, he looks lost. And there's way too many possessions where he's standing out in the corner. He's not really doing anything. And I'm going, why? Why is that guy standing out here in a tight Grizzlies game? There are too many possessions where defensively, and I don't know all of their defensive coverages or what he's supposed to be doing on some of these. And I'm actually seeing a highlight where he got a block and he looked great on the possession. But there's too many times where he's just kind of like hanging out the perimeter. He's not around the basket, and this team struggles to get rebounds. And I'm like, why are you out there doing what you're doing right now, not being engaged, not actually digging in on defense? His body language at all, it doesn't look right. It's off. And the idea that Pascal Siakam should be getting you 18-6, that to me is a complete shifting of what the expectations were for this player a couple of years ago. And it's like, okay, that's fine if he's that guy, but then, like, we got to have different conversations here.
Yeah, 18-6 is too light. Like, the 40-degree days. And it's tough. You're not going to have it every night. And this, hey, having 17-plus in 5 games in a row is great. It's nice that there's a floor there at the offensive end.
Great, he's not having Scotty Barnes.
And he's not having those 4-point nights. But they need a little bit more. The VanVleet thing is interesting. He's had a rough 3 games as a playmaker. And he's been fine as a scorer in terms of, like, efficiency. But negative assist to turnover ratio over the last three.
I was going to say, you haven't felt that? Because to me, I've really been watching Fred going, I love Fred VanVleet, and I think that he is just like the reason to watch Raptors games right now. Like genuinely.
But there's not many, so.
There's also an element with him, though, where like, yeah, the playmaking's down a little bit. You look at the on-off stuff, he's still like, they only have a prayer in these games when Fred's on the floor.
That's very clear.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that at some point, if you want to keep the Kyle Lowry comparisons going, it's that Kyle Lowry's playmaking compared to Fred's is non-comparable, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, Kyle Lowry.
Yeah. You're the point guard. And I know that you want to be the shooting guard, but hey, like, let's see you do some point guard things. Let's see you. I don't want to see my starting point guard with three assists. I'm sorry. I also,
this is a credit to Fred, but I also don't want to see my starting point guard lead the team in rebounding.
Yeah, that was not good.
How much of this is on Nick Nurse? Like, we don't talk about what the coach can do really much in this, like, the last couple of weeks when how the Raptors have been playing and how they've been on a pretty miserable streak. We talk about the players and we talk about the defense and the offense, but we haven't really gone too much into what can Nick Nurse do or how much of this is on his shoulders.
Yeah, Nick Nurse gets a little bit of the nice situation where, hey, if you make it work on a night, you have to play Yuta, Bonga, Svi, and stuff like that, you get the credit. But if it doesn't work, you like, what are you supposed to do? I had to start Svi Mykhailiuk.
Right. I like Yuta. I don't like lineups where he's the best player.
Yeah, I thought he was good last night, but like 29 minutes, three games. Like, this guy's supposed to be on a minutes restriction. Played 29 minutes last night. So I think Nick's in a bit of a, not no-lose situation, because he's also in a no-win situation, but I do think there's some stuff process-wise that, you know, I think maybe it's a little too, hey, Fred and Pascal will get theirs, and we don't need to be intentional about going after that. And this is something that it probably fits more in a video form of just like, hey, here are some ways you could get Siakam and Fred, like, use that pairing and how much attention defenses have to pay to them to get some stuff going. And those two in a pick and roll together hasn't been used a ton yet. And you can do that both ways. You can have Siakam handle too and Fred screen, and then he gets to kind of pop off the ball. But yeah, there's some more stuff you can be doing there. The lineup stuff, I don't love playing four of those bench guys together or an entire bench unit. And I don't love VanVleet playing 42 minutes, but like, also, VanVleet played 42 minutes because otherwise you're playing all those bench guys together. So rotation-wise, there's not as much he can do there. But yeah, offensive process-wise, there's more they can be doing, especially with their top guys. So one quick one before we break, because we got a break. Chris Boucher got a DMPCD last game, only played 7 minutes in this one. He was set to check in anyway, but really he came in when Siakam picked up his fifth foul. He was the 10th man in the rotation. Is this like message sent, obviously, with the DMPCD and you're fighting with Bonga and Champagne for minutes, but I know you've been progressively more out on Boucher, JD.
Last night, I liked that role for Boucher. It's weird, but I like 7 minutes of Chris Boucher. I do. I like when Chris Boucher comes in off the bench for 7 minutes and gives you a little bit of instant offense and some energy. But then anything more than that, there's too many flaws. And on a team like this, where, like, Blake's talking about the coaching and you needing more buy-in and you're trying to develop something, like, I don't think that you can develop your team very well when you have somebody like that who is just going to take every shot and is going to play sort of selfish basketball, like hunting for blocks and hunting for points. And I don't like this because it sounds like I'm just, like, kicking the guy while he's down. But I don't think Chris Boucher is a winning player.
You know who is a winning player? A lot of the Toronto Maple Leafs. And we're giving away Leaf tickets.
The opposite. These two teams, they just can't be on the same, like,
ever.
And they share the same arena, and they couldn't be more polar opposite. But Leaf fans, listen up. We're giving away a pair of tickets to the Leafs' December 9th home game against the Tampa Bay Lightning. All you have to do is download today and Thursday's episodes of the Fan Morning Show and listen for the different code words that will be placed in each podcast. Then text the code word to 590-590, and you'll be entered for a chance to win. Each code word counts as one entry. The winner will be announced this Friday, December 3rd. So if you want to see your Toronto Maple Leafs play a pretty tough team, the Tampa Bay Lightning, on December 9th, listen for the sneaky code word that I have placed in either today or tomorrow's episode of the Fan Morning Show. and send the code in, and you could be checking out those Leafs at home. And they are returning back home tonight against the Colorado Avalanche, which will be a big testing game. And we're going to have one of the most well-known fans of the Toronto Maple Leafs on next. Steve Dangle from the Steve Dangle Podcast Network is going to join us at 8 o'clock. So stay tuned, and we'll catch you right after the break.